From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Throughout its 125-year history, the magazine The Nation has consistently done two things: criticize the American government and lose money. On this edition of Fresh Air, the editor of The Nation, Victor Navasky, talks with us about political dissent in America. Also today, Guatemalan writer Arturo Arias on how his country's literary and political heritages intersect. Arias is the head of the Guatemalan chapter of PEN, the International Writers Organization. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the posthumous album from guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Tune In Tomorrow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. As Congress moves toward a weekend adjournment, the final conference reports on the major spending bills are now hitting the floor. The largest of these, a multi-billion dollar spending bill, was approved by the House today. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The $268 billion defense appropriation bill passed the House by voice vote in all of 10 minutes this afternoon, but it's the product of many months of negotiations. Although the bill substantially reduces defense spending levels requested by the president, it's hardly the peace dividend that some had predicted. The administration's $4.7 billion request for Star Wars, or the Strategic Defense Initiative, is cut by $2 billion, and funding for the B-2 stealth bomber has been reduced to keep the program alive for just 1 year. But the bill funds full-scale development of the Advanced Tactical Fighter, an aircraft that's slated to replace Air Force F-15s by 1996, and development of the STRAM-T, a standoff tactical nuclear weapon. Under the spending plan, U.S. uniformed troops will be cut by 78,000 men and women. The bill still must pass the Senate. It's supported by Defense Secretary Dick Cheney and is expected to be signed by the president. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Fighting continued today between India's Hindus and Muslims, leaving at least 60 people dead. The violence began with protests over the arrest of a right-wing Hindu party leader who was charged with stirring up religious hatreds. The leader, L.K. Advani, was trying to mobilize support to build a Hindu temple on a site that's also claimed by Muslims. Advani's Hindu Revivalist Party has withdrawn from the coalition government headed by Prime Minister V.P. Singh. Singh appealed for calm today, saying the government's worst fears have become a reality. Pakistan's caretaker prime minister has urged Benazir Bhutto to accept her party's defeat in the general election. He said it was the verdict of the people. Lise Doucette of the BBC reports.
The Islamic Democratic Alliance, to which Mr. Dutoy belongs, won 105 seats, just short of a majority. How, he asked, could anyone rig such a large number of seats? Ms. Bhutto's charges were baseless, he said. He accused her of double standards, pointing to her charges of rigging in the 1988 elections, which she nonetheless won. She accepted her victory then, he said, adding she should be a good loser now. In a news conference which concentrated more on attacking Ms. Bhutto than on discussing his alliance's victory, Mr. Dutoy said Pakistan has to move forward, and they had to march together. We must put the elections behind us and devote our attention to pressing economic and regional problems. Whether this was a genuine olive branch to Ms. Bhutto wasn't clear, but it's a branch she's unlikely to accept now, given her bitter condemnation of the election results.
Lise Doucette in Islamabad. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 20 points today to close at 2,484.41. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Someone once described the weekly The Nation as the magazine for the permanent minority. With a description like that, it would be easy to think the magazine was doomed to a short life. But The Nation has been publishing dissenting political opinions with a leftist perspective for 125 years, making it the oldest weekly magazine in the U.S. There's a new anniversary anthology of essays and poems spanning the magazine's history. The afterword was written by my guest, Victor Navasky. He's been The Nation's editor-in-chief since 1978. His book about blacklisting in Hollywood, Naming Names, won a 1982 National Book Award. In its founding statement, The Nation pledged to wage war upon the vices of violence, exaggeration, and misrepresentation by which so much of the political writing of the day is marred. This is how Navasky describes The Nation today.
The goals of The Nation. We are, let's see, a dissenting Journal of Opinion, and I guess our goals are to tell the truth and to make trouble and to monitor the major media, to look particularly closely at the intelligence agencies, which generally operate in secret, and to put new issues on the national agenda and to get America out of the Gulf.
Now, how does that compare? Right, a little specificity there.
Right.
How do the principles that you just mentioned, with the exception of the Gulf, compare with the founding principles in 1865?
Well, actually, the Gulf is relevant to it in this way only, that the nation, when it was founded by E.L. Godkin, was founded by people in and around the abolitionist movement, and they had a deep commitment to making society work for the newly freed men, as it were, and women. They called them freed men at the time. But shortly after the magazine went into business, the founding editor, Godkin, had a falling out with his backers because half of them really wanted the magazine to be a house organ for the radical Reconstructionist movement. And Godkin, while he was sympathetic without question with the goals of Reconstruction and a small-D Democrat and deeply committed to civil rights as we understand them now and human rights as we understand them now and even civil liberties, really did not want to be the house organ of anybody. And in the magazine's original prospectus, it said it would be the organ of no sect or party. But he did want to put out a good magazine. And so and one of the things that right from the start the magazine staked out as a position that's been a consistent position through the years, one of the few consistent positions, I might say, in addition to its commitment to human rights and liberties, was a kind of anti-imperial stance. And so you can just go through the history of this country, whether it's the Philippines or Nicaragua or Haiti or Vietnam or the Gulf, the nation has pretty consistently raised questions about it right up to this week, but a couple of years ago, I guess Gore Vidal did an article for us where he quoted Mark Twain, where Mark Twain said that it's impossible to maintain an empire in apropos of our invasion of the Philippines. He said it's impossible, I think, to maintain an empire in the Orient and maintain a republic at home.
The nation has lost money each of the 125 years it's been published. How much did it lose this past year? Like, what do the books look like now?
Oh, I can't count that high. We don't know yet how much we've lost this past year, but it's in the six figures. And I have a kind of theory that my publisher doesn't agree with me on, Arthur Carter being our publisher, which is that one of the reasons that the magazine has survived for 125 years is that we've lost money. And what I mean by that is that had we started to make money, the first thing that happens these days, if you start to make money, is you become a target for takeovers. But whether or not you're a target for takeovers, people get involved with you because they think they can make more money. And there are a lot of ways to make more money with a magazine like The Nation. One way would be to print us on slicker paper. A second way would be to put a fancier cover on so they could sell copies on newsstands. And once you do that and your circulation starts going up, you're more appealing as an advertising vehicle. So then you have to change your production schedule in order to accommodate advertisers plan your pieces way in advance so you can't be on top of the news anymore. And then you start trimming editorially in order not to offend your advertisers. And before you know it, you're like everybody else and there's no need to have you around anymore and you don't do it as well as everybody else. So that's been the history of a lot of magazines that are now in the great magazine graveyard. So that's what I mean when I say that one of the secrets of the nation's survival for 125 years is that it's lost money for virtually every year of its existence.
Does that make your publisher also your patron?
Well, our publisher doesn't agree with this thesis, and he thinks that what we have to say is important enough that if we're ingenious enough, we can find a large enough audience that can make it a self-sustaining publication, and he won't have to be our patron. He would just preside over a kind of break-even operation. He's certainly not in it for the money. He's in it because he thinks it's important to have a journal of commentary and dissent around. And I must say that since I've been there, well, when I got there in 78, we were told the circulation was 25,000, but when we looked at the number of paid subscribers, it was actually 20,000. There were 5,000 who were about to be renewed, and some of them paid and some of them didn't. And it's now 91,000 subscribers and a few thousand newsstand readers, and we've just done a mailing, and so we have more coming in. And so maybe it will keep growing. And I think in times of trouble, we used to have a joke that Reagan was bad for the country but good for the nation. I think in times of trouble that people really look elsewhere than to the official organs and voices for their information and their understanding of what's going on.
Well, in fact, last month you started a series on the peace movement in the nation, and it was a series on the goals and strategies of the peace movement in the light of the Gulf crisis and the end of the Cold War. Did you think that the opposition was especially quiet in the first few weeks of the Gulf crisis, and perhaps still?
Yeah, I don't think there was an opposition at the beginning, virtually. I mean, and it is a kind of convention in this country that when the troops are sent overseas, you're supposed to rally around the president. But I think this time the action was so precipitous and out of proportion to the problem that it was, to me, kind of astounding that the major media and the Congress were so silent. Now, there were pockets of opposition around the country, some of them the usual suspects and some of them unusual. It was not surprising, for example, that Noam Chomsky was an articulate opponent of America's unilateral action in going over there before it got the UN to approve the sending of troops over there. But it was of interest that Pat Buchanan and a group of conservative theorists also raise questions about it. So I think every day you see new signs that this almost this united front is less and less united.
Having surveyed the opposition, have you reached any conclusions about where the unity is in the peace movement on what the strategies and direction should be?
Yeah. We are still in the midst of our symposium on this, and we're running a series of pieces, and Andy Kopkind has one that'll be coming out soon. And I don't think there is a strategy, and I don't think there is an agreement on the left about where the peace movement is headed, and I think, or should be headed. I think that there was a in the post-Cold War aura and era, which was dawning as the Gulf thing came up. The people were trying to sort out what next. And this Michael Clare, who runs a peace center up at the Five Colleges in Northampton, Massachusetts, wrote an article for The Nation on in which he argued that basically our response in the Gulf was an atavistic Cold War response, inappropriate to the circumstance, but that it what it suggests is that we are planning to be the policemen for the world and, in effect, the mercenaries to put down problems in countries around the world that eventually Germany and Japan and other wealthier countries will pay for. And, you know, if he's right in that projection, then I think the role of the peace movement will define itself. I also think that the rise of the United Nations as a factor in as a possible factor in making for global peace will also inform the and should inform the future direction of the peace movement and some of its focus.
The Gulf is the first time we've really deployed lots of troops from the volunteer army. For a long period of time. I'm wondering if you think the volunteer army has anything to do with the slowness of the peace movement in mobilizing. I guess what I'm asking is, do you think a lot of people in the middle class feel less personally threatened because the middle class, for the most part, doesn't have sons and daughters in the military now that there's no draft?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not a direct threat in the way there was, say, during Vietnam.
Right.
You know, to the sons and daughters of the middle class.
Yeah. No, I think that's part of it. And we're not at war, and that's part of it. And it's not, even though one hears a lot about it on television, it's not real yet to people. That's part of it. And I think it's a matter that, you know, if we go to war, there will not just be a peace movement here, there will be repression at home, and these things have a way of, I think each generation plays it out in a different way, but I think it's going to be much, if we went to war over there in a kind of strange way, it would be much worse and more dangerous more violent here than during the Vietnam War, where you had maybe, you know, a Kent State and random acts of violence by fringe peace groups. Here, it's just, it is a new world. And also the tactics of Hussein himself are such that I think you might find violence on his part in this country if we went over there.
What kind of violence are you thinking of?
Oh, what is technically known as terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
I also think, you know, he would probably attack Israel, which would shatter the old alliance. And it just is, it's hard to understand why the Democratic Party, or at least elements of the Democratic Party in the Congress, aside from random individuals like Henry Gonzalez and a couple of others, are not really making a national debate out of this.
Do you think the Democrats really haven't been much opposition to the Republicans at all?
Well, I think that the Democrats and the Congress are as a whole, are in a shambles. And I think, you know, we just heard that the attempt to override the president's veto on the civil rights bill failed by one vote. Well, first of all, the bill that he vetoed was a disgracefully watered-down version of the original civil rights bill. And secondly, to lose by one vote is sad. It's also a sign of lack of will. It comes after the fiasco surrounding the budget and the inability of the Democrats to stake out a clear position in advance of the first act of the fiasco. There is a kind of set of movements around the country that reflect the belief on the part of the public that either government doesn't matter or that Congress is in such, and the government is in such bad shape that we really want to start from scratch. And this kind of notion is expressed in the movement to limit the term of representatives to X number of years or terms. And that's both at the state and local level. And some people have made proposals to have a 6-term limitation nationally. Micha Sifri, who's an editor at The Nation, wrote an article for us, which was reappeared as an op-ed article in the New York Times this week, where he urged the adoption of what he calls NOTA, which stands for none of the above. And the way it would work is that where you say in New York, you have a choice right now between Mario Cuomo, the governor, and Pierre Renfre, his opponent, there are a couple of other nondescript characters there, but you'd have a third choice there, and it would say, or none of the above.
So you would be accused of being apathetic if you didn't like either of the candidates.
Well, no, you not only wouldn't be accused of it.
You'd be registering your dissatisfaction.
You not only would be registering, but if we adopted this system legislatively, and there are ways to do that, and in Nebraska they have a variation of it, in Vermont they've talked about it, in the Soviet Union they did a version of it in their recent elections. If none of the above got more votes than either Cuomo or Renfre, then under the rules that Micha, our editor, is proposing, there would have to be a new election, and Cuomo and Renfre would be disqualified from running. And you would keep having elections until you got a candidate who got more votes than none of the above. And it's a kind of ingenious gimmick. It is a gimmick, but it's an appropriate expression and a kind of populist expression of a way of dealing with the fact that 50% of the people in this country in a national presidential election, forget local and primary elections where the number is much greater, don't think it's worth bothering to go to the polls anymore because they don't see any difference between the two parties, or they think that government is so distant from them that it doesn't matter, or they're so bored by the way the issues are presented to them through the press, through television, and through their representatives that they don't know about it.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Victor Novasky, and he's been the editor-in-chief of The Nation since 1978. The magazine is celebrating its 125th anniversary this year, and a collection of articles, essays, poems, and drawings from The Nation has just been published by Thundermouth Press. This is Fresh Air. Victor Novasky is my guest. He's the editor-in-chief of The Nation. Many of the Arab countries think that there should be linkage between Israel's withdrawal from the occupied territories and Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait. Do you think that Israel should be brought into discussion of a settlement?
Well, I'd put it a different way. And my own view is that linkage is not the issue, that without, in my mind, it is inevitable that if the problem in that if we resolve our differences over there and if we pull out and if Iraq pulls out of Kuwait, that the next thing that's going to happen is there will be an international conference on the Middle East and the Soviets will be part of it and it probably will be under UN jurisdiction. So whether or not you have linkage, it's in the cards now. It's not in the cards if there's a world war, but it is in the cards if we somehow manage to transcend what looks like a bungling into a world war situation. I also think that the logic of our position is that if there is and ought to be no linkage, then we ought to get on with what we were doing before, which is to encourage the peace process. And since the Soviets have now demonstrated that they are a reliable and third party in this thing, to invite them in, and we can, without linkage, without talking to Saddam Hussein about it, we can do unilaterally attempt to revive the peace process as between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Now, you can say that's unrealistic, but it seems to me that logically that's what ought to be happening, so that the issue of linkage is it's a red herring.
I want to ask you about your book, Naming Names, which was about the communist hunts in America. More specifically, it was about the, you called it a moral detective story, that examine the people who informed and what their motives are and why people do something that they probably wouldn't do under most circumstances. The book is getting republished in 1991. Are you going to be updating it in any way?
Well, I've written an afterword that sort of updates it. It's not, you know, it looks back. And in it, I point out that the book was published just before Ronald Reagan became president, and people who at first thought of it as a kind of a history of something that was irrelevant to our present circumstance after Reagan became president would ask me, how did you know it would be so timely? Because he appeared to be ushering in a new era of repression. I mean, when he came in with a report by the Heritage Foundation that advocated the reinstallation of the House Un-American Activities Committee and a whole agenda letting the FBI, letting the CIA operate on American soil, letting the FBI put informants in anti-nuclear organizations and other dissident organizations, which the government judged to be operating in ways that conflicted with the national interest and otherwise engaging in surveillance and punishment of people because of their political beliefs. So I think there was at the beginning, a great fear that we were in for another period of McCarthyism. And I think what we got was not that, but we got something that in some ways is more insidious. We didn't get the open kind of ritualistic insistence that individual citizens betray their friends or themselves and go through these rituals of self-condemnation in order to be able to practice their calling or to function in politics, science, or teaching, or the entertainment world. But what we did get was the kind of the institutionalization of some of the worst practices of the police or garrison state. For example, the CIA was, by administrative ruling, permitted to operate on American soil. The so-called Names of Agents Bill was passed, which for the first time in the history of this country criminalized the publication of information which was already a matter of public record. You can go down the list of what the administration did at home, and then abroad it was paralleled by what I think of as the overtization of covert action. I mean, it used to be that the FBI would do things like infiltrate the Black Panthers and put agents provocateurs in peace organizations and denied they did them because they were thought to be un-American and fundamentally outside of what a democratic society should do. In the same way, abroad, even though we were involved in the overthrow of the Mossadegh regime in Iran and we participated in the coup in Guatemala and we did all these other things over the years, they were covert actions because we were ashamed we were doing them. We didn't want to admit it. They violated international law, and they violated our own understanding of how a democratic society ought to deal with other peoples and ought to conduct its own affairs. Now, it's reported with a straight face in the New York Times and the Washington Post that yesterday the Congress voted on cutting off a certain kind of covert aid to Savimbi in Angola, but not another kind of covert aid, depending on what happens. So we're overt about what we used to be covert about. And that, to me, is a numbing of our democratic principles. And it's a theme that if you go back and look at whether it's in the Nation Anthology or in the progressive literature in this country and other places, that it's important to focus on.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's fun.
My guest has been Victor Navasky, and he's the editor-in-chief of The Nation. A new collection of writings from The Nation has just been published by Thundermouth Press to mark the magazine's 125th anniversary. And also a new edition of Victor Navasky's book, Naming Names, will be published early next year. Next time, writer Ann Fettner on viruses, the cause of diseases such as AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Arturo Arias's earliest childhood memory was of bombers overhead, part of a military coup in his home country of Guatemala. Coming up, Arias tells us about reliving that childhood experience through his fiction. When guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan died in a helicopter crash over the summer, rock lost one of its best-known bluesmen. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the album Vaughan finished just before his death. And Stephen Schiff reviews Tune In Tomorrow, a movie about a radio soap opera based on a novel by Peruvian writer Mario Vargas Llosa. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Final action on a budget bill is expected by the end of this week. Under the plan, a new 31% tax on families earning more than $100,000 a year will take the place of the so-called bubble, under which families earning between $80,000 and $200,000 a year now pay 33%. Gasoline prices are slated to go up 5 cents a gallon to 14 cents a gallon. On Capitol Hill, the Senate moved toward final passage of the 1990 Farm Bill today, a measure that would cut over $13 billion in the federal crop subsidy program over the next 5 years. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Today's debate on the Farm Bill follows a vote of approval in the House earlier this week. The Senate vote is the final step for the bill, which sets policy for the Agriculture Department for the next 5 years. On the floor, senators from farm states said the legislation is a death sentence for farmers because it makes large cuts in crop subsidies. Senate Agriculture Chairman Patrick Leahy said it's a difficult package to support because it represents a real effort to cut spending.
Smoke and mirrors are easy to vote for. Smoke and mirrors is easy to talk about. Smoke and mirrors is easy to give a speech about. This is reality. If we'd done more of this reality during the past 10 years, we wouldn't have the deficit we have now.
Although farmers aren't happy with the bill, environmentalists have praised it. The legislation includes measures to restore wetlands, prevent soil erosion, and track pesticide use. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Israel has turned down the latest UN Security Council resolution urging it to accept a UN mission to investigate the killings of Palestinians in Jerusalem earlier this month. Israeli officials have also expressed regret that for the second time in 2 weeks, the U.S. has supported a resolution critical of Israel. Alex Brody of the BBC reports.
The American plea to Israel to bend a little so this matter can be dealt with and attention refocused on the Gulf seems to have fallen on deaf ears. An aide to the Prime Minister, who was recently entrusted with a fence-mending mission to Washington, said the best thing to do with this new UN resolution was ignore it. The message is that Israel will not receive a UN mission to investigate the Jerusalem killings. It's a matter of principle, sovereignty over Jerusalem, and thus there's no room for compromise. All Israel seems to be offering is to send to the United Nations a copy of its own inquiry into the killings, which is due out soon. The Labour opposition has said it is unwise to take such a confrontational stance with the American government and has expressed concern at the deterioration of Israeli-American relations.
Alex Brody in Jerusalem. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 20 points to close at 2,484.41, volume 143 million shares.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Tune In Tomorrow. Blues guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan had finished recording a new album shortly before he died in August in a helicopter crash. The album was the first with his older brother Jimmy, the leader of the Fabulous Thunderbirds. The record's just been released, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
The death of Stevie Ray Vaughan was a terrible event made worse by a number of ironies. One is that after years of drug and alcohol problems, Vaughan had, by all reports, taken control of his life and was in solid shape. Another is that this new record, Family Style, is the best, most consistently enjoyable album that Stevie Ray Vaughan ever made.
That's my baby in the short skirt. Woo! rocks and roll.
There's an understandable temptation to overestimate Stevie Ray Vaughan's achievement in the wake of his death at the age of 35. He was an absolutely first-rate technician on the guitar, to be sure, and an effective singer with a harsh rasp that deepened his blues. But there was also a sense in which Vaughan was still unformed. He hadn't worked out his own style. Charles Shar Murray, in his terrific new book about Jimi Hendrix called Crosstown Traffic, says that Stevie Ray Vaughan was, quote, Jimi Hendrix's greatest living imitator. An awful irony there now, that living part. Murray went on to say that, quote, the first qualification for being a blues man is the ability to tell one's own story rather than simply recounting bits and pieces of someone else's. I agree with Murray's analysis of Vaughan's limitation, but would also suggest that on Family Style, he came very close to finally locating his own style. What I really like about Family Style is that it isn't a pure blues record. Blues purists can often be tiresomely repetitive, but on this album, Stevie Ray and Jimmy Vaughan reached out to other forms of music to enhance their basic blues. They made surprising connections to Philly Soul, for example, on TikTok.
The sick and the hungry, that smiles on their faces. The tired and the homeless, that family all around. The cities were all beautiful places. The walls came tumbling down. People of the world all had it together. Had it together for the boys and the girls and the children of the world. Look forward to a future. Remember.
On the instrumental Hillbillies from Outer Space, the brothers suggested that they'd spent a lot of time listening to the 60s instrumentals of Booker T and the MGs. But best of all, as far as I'm concerned, is the jumpy, ferociously aggressive rock and roll blues of Hard to Be. On Hard to Be, you can hear Stevie Ray Vaughan reaching past the blues, past his Jimi Hendrix addiction. He takes the best part of what his brother's blues rock band, the Fabulous Thunderbirds, have never quite captured on record. Style ends with a slow blues, the music that Stevie Ray and Jimmy had spent the rest of the record avoiding. The already legendary story is that this song was played live in the studio on one guitar, with Stevie Ray and Jimmy Vaughan passing the instrument back and forth between them. The song is called Brothers, and its implication of a new musical wisdom and a new partnership is quite literally Stevie Ray Vaughan's final irony.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Far away from his native Guatemala, novelist Arturo Arias monitors human rights violations against writers there. For the past 10 years, Arias has lived outside Guatemala, mainly in the U.S., but he serves as president of the Guatemalan chapter of PEN, the International Writers Union. It's a paradox, but most of the writers in the Guatemalan chapter are living in exile. They've also had a hard time getting their work published in Guatemala. Arias' novel, After the Bombs, was first published in Mexico in 1979. An English translation has just been published in this country by Curbstone Press. Arias writes in the Latin American tradition using symbolism and fantasy to tell a story. After the Bombs opens with the bombing of Guatemala City in 1954, a real event that Arias lived through.
I was then 4 years old. We had a democratic government, the government of President Arbenz, which was accused by the Eisenhower administration of being a communist government because it had passed a land reform program, which ironically was modeled on the U.S. land reform programs in the Pacific Rim after World War II. And so the equivalent of a contra army, a mercenary army, was assembled in Honduras, which is borders Guatemala, and they invaded Guatemala in June of 54. And there was... they were rebel planes, which bombed Guatemala City, mainly to scare the army into surrendering and to scare the civilian population. That they succeeded in doing very effectively, because among the scared civilians was my mother, who grabbed me, like I described in the beginning of the book, and threw herself under the desk as the planes dived and the bombs explode in the horizon. I was very young then, and it felt like, you know, like a World War II bombing, zillions of planes and bombings exploding all over. In fact, as an adult, when I've done research on it, there were only like two or three planes, and they threw only small bombs. But, you know, when you're under that, it felt like the whole world was falling apart. And so since the subjective, the emotional reaction was the initial one, that's the one I tried to capture in the book.
What was the political outcome of the bombing?
The political outcome was that the government resigned. The military came into power and stayed in power for 31 years. And Guatemala's atrocious record of human rights violations began, which made them world champion of human rights violations, the only thing Guatemala's ever been world champion at. So it was really the beginning of the end for Guatemala.
Your main character says at one point that their principal weapon is words. Do you believe that? Do you believe that that words are very effective in fighting against a government?
I would not claim that they are the only means of resisting a dictatorial government, but they are very effective because part of the logic of a dictatorial regime is that it tries to create a false history, the official story, to use the well-known phrase from the title of that movie. And so the job of the writer, of the artist, is to name the truth, to name the reality, to name that the emperor has no clothes. And part of the capacity of survival of a dictatorship is the degree to which it can pretend to the outside world that it's business as usual, that it is normal what's going on there, and the degree to which it gets called and named that it is not. And that international pressure begins to build, it becomes always an element of threat for the survival of that given dictatorship. So it is that role which intellectuals and artists and writers play, and it is why, whereas on the one hand, one is very weak, one is very vulnerable, nonetheless, you have an enormous amount of power to shape things by naming things that, say, a first-world writer or artist doesn't.
When did you leave Guatemala? I know you've been, you studied in the States, you've been teaching in the States. How old were you when you actually left there?
Well, I had left Guatemala many times, but originally I left when I was 19 and I got a scholarship to Boston University. That was the first time I officially left. At Boston, I got both a BA and an MA. Then I went to Paris and got a PhD in France. And the idea was to start teaching at the University of San Carlos as of January of 1980, which I did begin to do. But it was in January of 1980 that things began getting really out of hand in Guatemala. And shortly after that, General Lucas, who ran the country, said on national TV that the University of San Carlos was the center of subversion in the country. And everybody who worked at the university, their names began to appear in death lists. An army jeep machine-gunned students worked at a student bus stop in front of the campus. And so when Easter vacation came around, I went on vacation to Mexico and didn't come back.
And have you gone back since?
Yeah. I stayed away from Guatemala between 1980 and 1985. When Vinicio Cerezo became president in 1986, I began coming back to the country, and I've made a point of coming back at least once a year since then.
Is it frustrating to you that Americans seem to know a lot less about Guatemala than they do, say, about El Salvador or Nicaragua?
It is frustrating. I think that it is logical to the degree that there is more direct U.S. presence in both El Salvador and Nicaragua. What the Guatemalan army succeeded in doing was in becoming less dependent on direct U.S. military aid, and as a result, they became much less of an issue inside the U.S. and, you know, inside Congress. And therefore, they were able to implement the policies that they implemented with much less of a, you know, of a screening eye from the U.S. And I think that one of the elements that play out there is also a racist element. Most of the people who were killed in Guatemala in the 1980s were Indians, Mayan Indians. And Guatemala is itself a very racist country. It is almost, you know, like South Africa in a way, except without an institutional apartheid. But the separation between mestizos and Indians is just as dramatic. And so it was passed as if, well, you know, there's nothing dramatic here because it's just Indians who are dying. So what's the big deal?
How did you start writing and what kind of books did you have to read when you were growing up?
Well, I always wrote. Somehow writing always attracted me, not just writing, but storytelling. I began my first novel when I was 8, and of course I never finished it, and it wasn't any good either, but just to show that the interest was there. And my main interest was not just that I liked to write, but that I liked to tell stories. I saw myself as a storyteller, and I always loved to tell stories and to invent on reality. At the time, like most kids, I guess, my age, I was reading adventure novels. In Guatemala, we're speaking now middle 50s, among the authors that seemed to be very popular at the time, there was, of course, Jules Verne. There was Emilio Salgari, the Italian one who wrote about all those pirates and things. And so there was a sense of adventure and a sense of fantasy and of escape from the reality, which always seems so oppressive in Guatemala through literature. Now, when I was growing up, TV still didn't exist in Guatemala, so that literature was still the primary way of escaping reality, of visualizing alternative worlds, of flowing into an imaginary world. And therefore, the link between imagination and language took place very, very early and became a very dynamic process in my own life. I imagine that to some degree with newer generations, this may be changing. Nonetheless, since Latin America still produces very little film and TV on its own, literature is still the primary space in which one confronts oneself, in which one confronts society, in which one tries to shape a national identity. Whereas in the first world in general, of course, cinema and TV have displaced literature in that function.
What about radio? I know radio has been very popular in Latin America, and certainly the soap operas.
Oh, yes. Radio soap operas were great, and I used to listen to them, too. Basically, what radio did for me was sharpen the ear for storytelling, for plot structures, and for popular usage of language, which has always fascinated me too. Most of the soap operas dealt with lower middle class people, at least the ones I heard. And so I was exposed to a different language, to a different Spanish than the one that my intellectual middle class family normally employ on a daily basis. And therefore, the play with language was very, very important for me, and the sense of plot, the sense of dramatic tension. And the other voice that I think was important for me and was important for many writers, like any average middle-class family in Latin America, we had maids. And those maids were Indian, and they told us all kinds of wonderful stories about, you know, legends, ghost stories, all kinds of things. And that definitely was a very contributing factor to the shaping of my imagination. And I know that it was so of other writers who have lived in the same environment.
What language are you writing in now?
Spanish. I always write my fiction in Spanish. I have done academic writing in English. I'm a professor, too. But when it comes to fiction writing, to novel, only Spanish, I don't think that I can ever, no matter how good my English ever gets, be able to have the subtlety and the inside knowledge of the language that I do in Spanish.
And what language do you read in? Do you read in Spanish and English?
I read in Spanish, English, French, Portuguese, and a little bit of Italian.
Boy, I envy you knowing so many languages. I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing.
It was my pleasure.
And Arturo Arias has been my guest. His novel, After the Bombs, has just been published in English. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, Linda, at long last, a budget.
Be still my heart, Terry. We're leading the show with an analysis of what the Congress and the President are doing on the budget. We also have a long piece on California politics, which I did. The governor's race out there is a close one, and dependent upon the outcome is how the state apportions its new congressional seats. California will get 7 new seats. Latinos want 1 of them. Troop movements in Kuwait by the Iraqis will have some analysis and a piece on halls of fame.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The movie Tune In Tomorrow opens in theaters this weekend. It's based on a novel by Peruvian writer Mario Vargas Llosa called Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Well, okay. So they chucked the novel's title in favor of the impossibly bland Tune In Tomorrow. And they changed the setting from Lima, Peru to New Orleans. And yes, they reduced all the intriguing plots within plots. But that's all right. At the beginning of Tune In Tomorrow, as its weird little jokes pelt you one by one, you feel like forgiving its trespasses. You settle in for a quirky good time. Prematurely, I'm afraid. The way this picture falls to pieces in front of your eyes is one of the strangest sights in recent movies. It seems to die of exertion, of the effort it expends straining to please us. The setting is a New Orleans radio station in 1951. That's where young Martin, played by the terminally awkward Keanu Reeves, works. And that's where the station's honchos hire a famous new scriptwriter. Pedro Carmichael is his name. And he comes along just in time to spank new life into the station's deadly daily soap opera and its stars.
Art! That's what I'm talking about. The very apex of your art! I want to hear your sinews crack and strain. I want your souls to enter those microphones and emerge like ghosts in the homes of our listeners. There's an army of them out there, groping blindly, toiling in the darkness, waiting. For what? For you!
That's Peter Falk, of course, one of the world's chewiest hams. And there's the cool, nimble acting of Barbara Hershey. She plays young Martin's Aunt Julia, a worldly divorcee who blows into town from New York and is immediately wooed by her smitten nephew, Martin, who's 15 years her junior. To her own amazement, she falls in love with him. Meanwhile, Pedro is coaxing their affair along for his own reasons. Their hanky-panky is providing him with terrific ideas for his soap opera. And the soap opera, in turn, seems to inspire the real lovers to even dizzier heights. Life feeds on art, and art on life. The trouble is, all of this is perfectly established by the middle of the movie, whereupon Tune In Tomorrow has nowhere to go but down. All along, we've been seeing Pedro's soap opera amusingly acted out for us by a crack team of stars, including John LaRoquette, Elizabeth McGovern, Peter Gallagher, and Hope Lang. Now that film within a film starts to repeat its best gags, and its tone becomes ponderous and wearisome. Pedro's technique of dressing up as his characters, which was fun at first, gets old fast. And the movie's little irritants, like Keanu Reeves' wobbly accent, come to seem more pronounced. The director, John Amiel, telegraphs some of his jokes and sledgehammers others, staging clumsy bits of slapstick and finally drowning us in sentimentality. It's all pretty amazing. In the space of a half hour, this formerly zingy comedy becomes nearly unbearable. In the end, Tune In Tomorrow doesn't just betray Vargas Llosa's wonderful novel. It betrays the very audience it works so hard to charm.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What's the difference between viruses and bacteria? On the next Fresh Air, medical writer Ann Fettner explains how viruses get into the human system, and we discuss her extensive investigation of the AIDS epidemic. Also, we meet writer Larry Brown, and Milo Miles reviews Paul Simon's new record. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.